I'm going to be telling you about allorecognition. I'm going to be telling you about something completely different. That's allorecognition in a basal chordate. And when I first started this work and was trying to get my head around transplantation biology, where I was working had a library with a lot of old books, and I read a lot of the Medawar papers and Burnett papers, which were so interesting to get an idea of what was going on. So I'm really excited to give you this talk today. And I'm going to start out, so we're interested in the evolution of immunity. And I'm going to start out, if you allow me to oversimplify a little bit, with how I think of it in context of this meeting. So transplantation immunity in vertebrates is a result of two things. One's the function of the MHC proteins themselves, which is in peptide presentation and as a self-ligand. And as a self-ligand, I mean both in case of MHC restriction and as a self-ligand for NK cells. But it's also important that the diversity of the MHC, the polymorphism, without polymorphism, there'd be no allorecognition. And the question really is, when I'm thinking about some of these things, is vertebrate allorecognition an artifact and just due mainly to the mechanics of MHC-based transplantation? Or did natural allorecognition play a role in the evolution of immunity, which is really what I'm going to tell you about? And there were these two quotes that I usually end my talk with, one by Medawar, which talked about mixing up the cells, that transplantation immunity may have a real function. And the second was from Burnett, who said that any search for the significant, prior to understanding T cell MHC based interactions, that any search for the significance of histochemical antigens was in their polymorphism. So the polymorphism was the key characteristic. And this suggested there was immunity, and this would be a result of that immunity, is this polymorphism in terms of real allorecognition. So why are we interested in this? We're interested in this because allorecognition responses are found throughout the metazoa and even in animals that made the unicellular to multicellular transition. And by that, in these old experiments that were done years ago, you just naturally mixed tissues or experimentally mixed tissues, and that resulted in, as we know, either a rejection where these interaction, where the interacting tissues were specifically destroyed, or an acceptance where you formed a chimera. And I've got in a couple examples here. So marine sponges are the simplest multicellular organisms, and they have a transplantation reaction, and shown right here, here's two pieces of a sponge. If you do an isogenic control, the two pieces of sponge kind of integrate together. If you do an allogeneic response, you actually get what's a rejection response where you see material laid down, and there's also some localized killing. This is also seen in cnidarians like corals and sea anemones, and this is actually a picture from Okinawa where two coral colonies have grown into each other and they're actually rejecting each other. And the rejection is a killing that goes along the line of interaction. This is also in another model called Hydractinia. This is seen where these are two compatible individuals and they fuse these things called gastrovascular swollens, okay? Or they can reject them, and mostly they reject. And there's always seems to be a genetic basis of this. And this is, of course, what everybody knows in the mouse, okay? So if you allow me another gross oversimplification, allorecognition in the vertebrates is a function of the immune system. I kind of alluded to this before. Just because it's a function of the immune system in the mammals doesn't necessarily mean it is in all the organisms, or does it? And that's kind of the questions we're asking. And it's mainly controlled by the major histocompatibility complex, which is a single locus with the rules that both alleles must match for acceptance. Okay, we all know that. And I know that's an oversimplification, but I'm just leading into something that I think is absolutely amazing and probably the biggest mystery in evolution, and that's this. This animal needs no introduction. And appears in the fossil record about 425 million years ago. Sharks have class 1, class 2, T cells, B cells, affinity maturation, they have memory, and they have primitive lymphoid tissue. And this has all been found over many years by a lot of groups. Go one step down the evolutionary ladder to the jawless fish. It appears just 50 million years before that, and there's nothing that we recognize in terms of mammalian adaptive immunity. There's no MHC, there's no immunoglobulin, there's no RAG, there's nothing, okay? And I want you to think about this. It's as if the whole system sort of appeared out of nowhere. Now we have 50 million years, we don't really have a fossil record, we don't know, but if you talk about the evolution of the brain or the evolution of the kidney or anything, you'd never see a step like this. And I think everybody in this room can appreciate the complexity that goes on between these different layers of the immune system. And it just is as if it appeared out of nowhere. And that just completely, it really is mind-blowing when you think what's going on. And I think we're starting to get some insight into that. I'm going to tell you about today. So that brings the long-range objectives of our lab in and that is we're trying to understand the molecular mechanisms that underlie allorecognition in non-vertebrates, and trying to understand, with those same studies, what are the evolutionary origins of the vertebrate adaptive immune system. We also are trying to understand the evolutionary functional relationships between innate and adaptive immunity, and I'm not really going to have time to talk about that, but I think we should start thinking about these two branches of immunity slightly differently. And is there any relationship between allorecognition and immunity in the long run, in terms of its evolution? So the species we work on is a basal chordate. It's called a tunicate. They're marine animals, and they're considered chordates because of their larval form. So embryogenesis results in a tadpole larvae. It has a notochord and a dorsal nerve tube, a pharynx with gill slits, all chordate characteristics. And these grow in marinas throughout the world, and they swim around for a little while, and they do something crazy. They lay down, they resorb their tail, and they metamorph into an invertebrate body plan. Okay, so they're the swing species between the invertebrates and the vertebrates. Now, our species does something else besides this strange thing, and that is, and a lot of marine organisms do this, it doesn't grow by getting bigger, it grows by asexually reproducing itself. So this is a body, it has a mouth, it has a gut, it has a central and the peripheral nervous system, and it doesn't grow by getting bigger, it grows by budding new individuals. So what you get eventually is a colony of genetically identical individuals. Each one of them is called the zooid, each one of them is a complex body plan. If you turn the colony over, these are about 5 millimeters in length, if you turn the colony over, all of the colony is connected by a common extracorporeal vasculature, which is lit up just by Fitz here, and this is the ventral view, and here are the bodies. And the vasculature runs throughout the colony, linking all of the zooids, or the bodies, but at the periphery of the colony stops in these little finger-shaped protrusions called ampullae, and it's there where the allorecognition response occurs. I'm going to tell you about it in a second. Now, this continues for the life of the colony. And there's two points I want to make here. One is this little tadpole settles down and starts to asexually expand outward. And the other is, and I hope I get to this in my half hour, is that in contrast to think how we think about development, in Betrillus, development is always occurring. Each week, each one of these bodies is reproducing itself. So every week, all organogenesis and all gametogenesis is going on anew in an asexual developmental process. Okay. So, where these guys grow, encrusting invertebrates, it's incredibly competitive for space. And this is a picture from Woods Hole on the dock at the Marine Biological Laboratory. And you can see lots and lots of Petrella schlosseri. And you can see all this color polymorphism. And you can understand by this picture that during their lifespan, they have a very good chance of growing into another individual. And when they asexually expand into another individual, that initiates an allorecognition response between the juxtaposed ampullae. So the colonies are growing out, the ampullae on the outside that are part of the extracorporeal vasculature, they're going to come together and touch. And when they do, this initiates a reaction. They touch and they can do one of two things. They'll either fuse together, forming a parabiotic pair and a hematopoietic chimera, or they'll reject each other. And this rejection is an active inflammatory reaction where these cells called morula cells come into the tips of the ampullae, and if a rejection response is going to occur, the ampullae become leaky, the cells par out, they pop open. Inside of them, they have the precursors for the prophenyloxidase pathway, turning tyrosine into melanin, and they get these, and they have these little melanin scars. So that's the rejection response, okay? So from touching to fusion or rejection takes about 24 hours. These are large structures. These are about 500 microns in length, and it's occurring outside the body. So it's a very easy thing to assay. Okay. Now, in addition to this, I want to tell you something for some future experiments, and that is rejection's not global. It's restricted to the ampullae that are in contact. So if a colony grows, as in this case, into a colony that it's not going to be compatible with, it can reject on one side and at the same time be fusing on the other side. So it's not a global response, it seems to be a localized response to the ampullae that are in contact. It become interesting in a minute. But why is this so interesting? It's the genetics. Fusibility in this case is controlled by a single locus, which we call FUHC, for fusion histocompatibility. It's highly polymorphic. There's probably 500 to 1,000 alleles of the FUHC worldwide. And the rules of FUHC-based allorecognition would be very familiar to those who work on natural killer cells. And that is two colonies will fuse if they share one or both alleles, okay? And rejection only occurs if they don't share any allele in common, okay? So only one allele match for compatibility, and there's no difference between the fusion in a double match or a single match. And the question, yeah, given this phylogenetic relationship, and given these very recognizable genetic rules of allele recognition, is the FUHC the ancestral MHC? So for Bacillus, we can grow them in the lab. They grow in these little glass slides, and you can see these colonies here. Okay, so we can cross them. We've produced inbred strains with known fusibility types. So for people that think about the origins of the inbred mice and mouse models, basically we just redid all of this work. The generation time is about 12 weeks. The genome size is about a quarter of a human. There's a genome published and a large transcriptome database. But one of the most powerful things of Bacillus as a model is this. And that is, all these bodies are connected by this common extracorporeal vasculature, but they're not dependent on each other. And this gives us a cool experimental trick, because we can cut these colonies into pieces, separate them, and they'll continue to grow. So we can do a control and an experiment on the exact same genotype. We can collect genotypes at different times, so on and so forth. So using that system, we positionally clone the FUHC locus. Okay. And at first, we were wondering, is the FUHC, and our working hypothesis was the FUHC might be the ancestral MHC, but it's not. And there's people have studied evolution of the MHC. There was ideas about linkage of certain genes, non-MHC genes, in different organisms, but we didn't see anything like this. It's a completely unique genome region, and there's nothing, there's no genes at all in this region that look anything like any genes in any other MHC. And right now, it's delineated to about 1.2 centimorgans. This is the physical map. It was physically mapped into three pieces, but the business end seems to be down here. Over a 550 kb region, there's six proteins I'm going to briefly tell you about that play a role in this allele recognition response. Okay, so the two most polymorphic proteins thus far are two that sit right next to each other, and we thought they were one gene for a while. Are called FUHC-seq and FUHC-TM. So FUHC, this is a secretory version, this is a transmembrane. FUHC-seq has a signal sequence, two EGF domains, and a carboxytail. The FUHC, the transmembrane portion, has a signal sequence, three immunoglobulin domains. They're not type 1, they're unique IG domains, a transmembrane domain, and an intracellular tail. And the tail has no signaling domains or anything like that. Both of these genes are highly diverse. This is DIVA analysis. And this is really interesting. So FUHC, the secretory version, is the most polymorphic protein in the locus. And you can see there's a lot of diversity. And this is just a deep analysis over the length of the protein. And you can see something here. People look at these MHC deep plots. Polymorphism is kind of spread randomly throughout the protein. And if this is one of the ligands, how that's interpreted, how that's recognized is really interesting. The transmembrane is similarly polymorphic, but not nearly as much as is secreted. There's evidence of positive selection in 17 codons of the FUHC-seq, but only 5 codons of the transmembrane domain. Okay, both of these are expressed, you can't see this very well, but these are the ampullae. This is the transmembrane. They're expressed on the tips of the ampullae as well as a subset of blood cells. But the secretory version is expressed at a much higher level, at least at the RNA level, than the transmembrane. And polymorphisms in both of these genes predict outcomes. We went out when we were doing these experiments and collected animals from different geographical locations that fused and rejected, or animals that live close together and rejected, tried to be as rigorous as we could about this. And we found that polymorphisms of both these genes predict outcome. And we haven't found a case where they don't yet. So they predict outcome, but we've just found some other genes do too. Okay, so that's sort of the backdrop. And what I want to talk about now is some of the insight we've gotten functionally from these studies by two other proteins that are also encoded in the locus. And I want to start here. How does an animal that doesn't, so there's no RAG in this animal, there's no AID in this animal, there's no evidence at all for any kind of diversification of the genes involved in this reaction. So how is it that they're able to discriminate? If we go out and I tell you there's 500 to 1,000 specificities in nature. So if we bring in two colonies, or we fly colonies from the East Coast to the West Coast, or the West Coast to the East Coast, they reject at the same frequency, right? So this tells you this system has incredible specificity. So how does it work? So the simplest explanation is that there's homotypic binding, right? That one allele binds itself. And that is the simplest, but I find that completely I don't think that could be true at all, because that would mean you would have a mutation that occurred that would be complementary and would only bind itself out of hundreds of other competing specificities. So I don't think this is really a reasonable way to think about this. As I said, there's no recombination, so receptors aren't tailored for each allele like the T cell is, right? And the single match rules, since you fuse with one allele match or both, tells you you're not directly recognizing one self. So what do we think is going on? We think this is a missing self type of recognition, that the effector system can discriminate both of the self FUHC alleles that it has, right, to find them on another animal. And there's three examples of this in the vertebrates, of course. The KIRA-LI49-MHC, the NKRP1B and OSL interaction that goes on, and SERP-alpha-CD47. So these are three very well-known missing self recognition responses. And how did we get into this? And we got very, very lucky because within this locus, one of the first genes we found that was polymorphic was a gene called FESTER. The FESTER has no real homology with other proteins, but it has a single sequence. The one domain we see is an SCR, our SUSHI domain that's found in complement receptors, has three tandem transmembrane domains, and again, a short intracellular carboxy domain, but without any sort of signaling domains at all. But FESTER was highly diverse. There's at least 60 alleles in the US, but the polymorphisms do not contribute to outcomes. So you can share a FESTER allele and reject, or not share one and fuse. There's different haplotypes of FESTER out there. I'm not going to really talk about that. But one of the things that was the most exciting was there was somatic diversity. And that is that we seem to see an individual specific diversification via alternative splicing. So what do I mean by that? So FESTER is encoded in 12 exons. And if we went through, and at first we were just doing this qualitatively by PCR, when we went through and looked at FESTER, we found that each individual that we looked at expressed a full-length form and then a repertoire of splice variants. So six of the 12 exons could be spliced out, and we would find that each individual had a repertoire of 8 to 24 different splice variants, and it seemed to be unique to each individual. This was semi-qualitative. And what would happen is we'd see one with this exon cut out or this exon cut out, and we've identified all, so there are six exons that could be alternatively spliced, and we've identified all 64 different splice variants in different individuals, although each individual seems to express just a small subset of these. Now, we've started to look at this more quantitatively by transcriptome analysis, and this is just work by Daryl Takeda in the lab, and this is different splice exon junctions in four different individuals, and you can see right here, I'm just trying to show you this, is that there's a lot of difference in exon-exon usage in different individuals. So we're starting to see this quantitatively now. So the take-home message is that FESTER, the FESTER locus, is being diversified. It's being diversified by alternative splicing, and each individual seems to be expressing a unique repertoire of alternative splice forms. So we made a monoclonal antibody to one of the alleles that we carried in the lab, which we call cleverly called the A allele. And this is immunofluorescence. The red is this monoclonal antibody called 5B1. And you can see that expression is out on the tips of the epithelia of the ampullae that will come together, as well as a subset of blood cells that are in the vasculature. And this is also expressed in the tadpole on what are going to become the ampullae as it goes through the metamorphosis. Now, Spencer Nyholm did an experiment where he did a monoclonal antibody binding experiment. And he took two colonies. And if the colonies were compatible, we're going to fuse, and you put the antibody in right as they were coming into contact, there was no effect. But if they were going to reject, okay, and you added the antibody, he could turn a rejection into a fusion. And this is my favorite picture of that right here, where these two colonies are coming in contact, the ampullae are in contact, you can see these rejection responses, but you see a nice fusion coming across the barrier here too in the presence of the antibody, okay? And in addition to that, for that experiment to work, both colonies had to contain the allele that we made the monoclonal antibody to, okay? And we were very excited about this because this suggested that FESTER was a receptor binding the self FUHC, okay, and initiating the response that would ultimately lead to a fusion between the two individuals. Okay, so basically, in NK parlance, FESTER would be an inhibitory receptor. and making things compatible. And that was great, except we were doing some other experiments, and that's not the result we got at all. And we were very lucky because we found that this regenerative potential of petrolis is not just normal, but it also responds to injury. We found out that if we cut off the ampullae, they would regenerate in about 48 hours. And not only that, they would regenerate in an educated fashion. So no loss of specificity would occur following the regeneration of the ampullae. At the same time, we were playing with siRNA, and we can just inject siRNA, and somehow it's taken up and protein expression is blocked. So now we could do something really cool. We could do a knockdown under conditions of regeneration, so we didn't have to worry about protein turnover during our knockdown in an adult. So what we would do is cut off we would inject them with siRNA, cut off the ampullae, and force them to regenerate under conditions of knockdown. Now by qPCR, you can see within 2 days, this is Fester. We had knocked down Fester almost completely using siRNA. So we always are quantifying what's going on after the reaction. And this is Fester, and this is an siRNA, a GFP, and you can see it's very specific for Fester. And that's shown also here by immunofluorescence. So these are regenerated ampullae under Fester siRNA with the Fester antibody, and there's no reaction at all, and this is with the control siRNA. So now we can regenerate ampullae that have certain proteins not present. And when we did this with Fester, we got a completely different result. If colonies were going to fuse, or if they were going to reject, when we knocked out Fester in both colonies, they did nothing. We got a no reaction phenotype. So the ampullae would come together, touch, and do nothing. And if we lifted the siRNA and stopped, within a few days they would fuse, reject normally. Okay, so this was a completely different response. And this suggested that Fester was involved in initiating the response. So just to summarize here, Fester is a polymorphic protein, but in order of magnitude less than the FUHC, and its polymorphisms don't predict outcome. It's somatically diversified by alternative splicing, and each individual expresses a couple common variants plus a bunch of unique ones, 8 to 24 of them. The monoclonal antibody interference experiment suggested this is a receptor responsible for recognizing FUHC polymorphisms, okay, and initiating the fusion response. But we got something completely different with the knockdown, and it suggested Fester might have dual roles. And we hypothesized at the time that the segregation of function may be reside in the different splice variants. So we don't know that. We haven't knocked out specific splice variants yet. But this brought up another question, and that's what's the relationship between fusion and rejection? And this is where I think we're starting to get insight into the evolution of immunity in general. Okay. And again, we got lucky, because right next to Fester, there was a duplication of this part of the genome of about 100 kb. And there was a protein encoded in there that looked a lot like Fester and had the same exact topology and an SCR domain. But the front end of the gene, the front half of the gene, was completely different, had no amino acid homology at all with Fester, where the back end of the gene was almost nearly 100% identical. So they gave the same exact topology. Now, because of this half relationship, we call this gene Uncle Fester. Okay. And the really interesting thing about Uncle Fester is there's no protein polymorphism of Uncle Fester in populations that we check on the east and west coast of the US at all. There is silent substitutions that are segregating, but no protein polymorphism. There's also a couple of splice variants, maybe two or three, that most of them we don't see in adults though. So this is work of Tanya McKittrick. So Tanya made a monoclonal antibody, and you can see that Uncle Fester is also expressed. These are up on the tips of the ampullae right here. And when we did FACS with both of the antibodies, we found there's a population of double-labeled, and this is Fester right here, Fester-positive, Uncle Fester-positive cells, as well as a Fester-positive, Uncle Fester-negative population of cells, which we think are in the blood. So we're starting to see a lot of diversity in expression of these different proteins. Now, Tanya repeated these experiments. She did Uncle Fester knockdown in rejecting colonies, and we got the same result as in Fester. And that is, if you knocked it out, Uncle Fester in both colonies, and they were not, and they were rejecting pairs, they gave what's called the no reaction phenotype. So you can see these ampullae come together, and they don't do anything for about 72 hours. And this is the control where you can clearly see the point of rejection. And Tanya sort of expanded this work too. And the next thing she did is she knocked out in one colony and paired it to an unmanipulated colony. And this was really interesting. So the knockout here is on the top, and at the bottom is the control colony that was unmanipulated. And what can you see when these come together is you see this initial inflammation of these cells into the tips of the ampullae. And you do see points of rejection coming out. And this is very interesting, but what it looks like, it's like the bottom colony is undergoing this rejection response, and the top colony looks like it's not. You don't really see at all any of this, of these melanin scars, and you don't really see any of this inflammation. Seems to be all down in the bottom colony. So this colony that has Uncle Fester's coming over and being stimulated, but this colony does not seem to be. She followed this up by doing a three-way assay where she knocked out colonies in the middle and on the right here, and this was paired to an unmanipulated colony. And if you look at this region here, these colonies are not reacting together. In this colony here, we see a very clear point of rejection. So the conclusions from these functional studies were that Uncle Fester is not involved in homotypic reactions, because we can still stimulate a rejection when an unmanipulated is paired to manipulated. Rejection is not global, which I told you at the beginning, but this was very important. Doesn't seem to be based in the blood. It's at the ampullae that are in contact. And these points of rejections are not due to direct allogeneic interactions. That's something we kind of knew, but not really. So that seems to be something downstream. But the real surprise came when she did it on compatible parents. When she knocked out Uncle Fester and compatible parents, whether both colonies were knocked down, or a knockdown colony was paired to unmanipulated colony, it had no effect at all. They fused normally under the normal time frame. And when we looked back to being sure that Uncle Fester RNAi didn't affect Fester expression, this is a colony with a Fester monoclonal antibody, under Uncle Fester knockdown, Uncle Fester is not expressed, Fester is expressed, so this doesn't need to be blocking Fester. So the conclusion from this experiment are that fusion and rejection are not mutually exclusive events. They seem to be two independent things that are going on, one a rejection pathway and one a fusion pathway. And she followed up on this experiment, and this is something that I'm very excited about, that we're doing quite a bit. Because this occurs outside of the body on these ampullae, we can actually touch these ampullae. You can touch them with a pipette tip. And she did this really cool experiment. So she took her monoclonal antibody, now they're growing on glass plates in the water. She put her monoclonal antibody onto magnetic beads, took a magnet underneath, and touch the ampullae with it. And here's a picture of that right there. And the ampullae she touched with one of her monoclonals called 2B6 induced a really strong rejection response, only where the antibody touched. So she touches with the antibody here, you see this darkening and this huge response, rejection response, where we're seeing POR forming, while on the other side, the unmanipulated side, or if we did it with antibody, with control antibodies, we saw no response at all. Okay, so she can induce a rejection response using this monoclonal antibody. So the next experiment she did was sort of the other way of what Spencer Nyoman did with this monoclonal antibody blocking experiment on rejecting colonies, and that is she took fusing colonies, put the antibody right on the interface of the two fusion colonies, and she could turn a fusion into a rejection that way, suggesting you're overriding the fusion response and inducing a rejection response. And the people studying NK cells were looking at a balance then, what looks like a balance of input signals that are then somehow being integrated inside the cell. So we can take a single colony and stimulate to reject in vivo. These responses are, again, this experiment has shown you, limited to the ampullae that are actually stimulated. And fusion can be blocked by an overstimulation of the rejection pathway. Okay. So Uncle Fester's non-polymorphic family member in the FUHC locus near the Fester locus initiates a rejection response but has no effect on fusion, telling us that the pathways are not mutually exclusive. We know now that phenotypic rejection is downstream of the recognition event. And this is one big issue when we compare to mammals, right? Because we always have this sort of mammalian paradigm in our mind, but in this case, fusion rejection is downstream, we think, of the recognition, not directly due to the same. So the killing or the response is not being done by the same cells that do the recognizing, right? Okay. Now the severity of rejection can be manipulated, and we can stimulate a rejection and we can override a fusion in progress, which is the other way of with the antibody to Fester, which overrode a rejection and turned it into a fusion. And this suggests that signals from tuning pathways are integrated. Okay. Now for FUHC, we've had trouble knocking this protein. We're not really sure. So this is the secreted protein, and we don't have a good antibody, which is why I haven't published this data yet. But when we knocked out, if the secreted or TM proteins are missing self ligands, knocking them out, should turn a fusion into a rejection. And that's what we saw, and that is what we've seen we're doing. This is shown here. So this is an isogenic pairing. They're both knocked out for the FUHC, and you see this very clear rejection response. But our knockdown on this has been inconsistent, and since we can quantify our knockdown, we're trying to figure out what's going on, and we don't have a good antibody. So until I have that, we're not really look at that, or that's still going to remain unpublished until we figure that out. But there was another piece of evidence about what's the ligand that came from several studies. So from Irv Weissman's lab, Virginia Schofield, who really sort of initiated a lot of this work, she had published a paper where she found that the severity of the rejection maps to the FUHC locus. So if you went out and paired colonies, we'd see kind of a range of rejection responses. Some would be very rapid. Within 12 or 16 hours, you see these huge points of rejection. Sometimes it's a little weaker, it takes 48 hours. Sometimes it's even weaker than that. It'll take 72 hours, and you get kind of little tiny scars that aren't really that impressive at all. So there seemed to be a range of these rejection responses. And she did this beautiful genetic study and found that map to the FUHC locus. So what we're thinking is this. If there's two pathways that integrate, a rejection pathway and a fusion pathway, okay, and you have alleles that are very similar, then when you bound, you would start to lower the response of the rejection pathway. So closely related alleles should have weaker and weaker. So if you have two animals that don't have the same allele, but they're very closely related, we would predict then that that would be a less severe of a rejection response. And we do have evidence for that. So we've been looking through different alleles. And one thing that came about in one of our crosses was there was one pairing that it was the only missed score in about 150 pairings. And the notes for the response were that we saw something completely different, but we never really saw a fusion, but we never really saw a rejection either. And that's kind of shown right here. Under normal rejection response, ampullae sort of come together. If they're going to fuse, and I don't know if you can see this very well, they penetrate into the other individual, and that's sort of shown here. And what we found basically was we saw this penetration phenotype, but only when the secreted form was closer related. So this was a group of alleles that we looked at that we were correlating the severity of the rejection to the different alleles, and what we found is it seemed to correlate with closely related secreted alleles. Okay, and this gave, when we use these two alleles, which should reject, they only really had six differences among about 550. These are the closest alleles we found, and they give almost no rejection response at all. And there was another paper published that suggests that two colonies with fused allele that fused had alleles that differed by a single amino acid. So it gets into the question of how specific is this? How many amino acid changes have to occur on this protein in order to be recognized as a different specificity? And that's one of the questions we're looking at. So several independent results suggest the secreted form is a ligand. It's the most polymorphic protein. These differences in the polymorphism seem to correlate with the severity of rejection. And then we have the knockdown phenotype, but we have a lot more to do on this. So that's sort of where we're sitting right now. How much time do I have, by the way? Am I doing okay? I'm just about done. So I want to go to our model then. Our model is this. When two ampullae come together, there seems to be an activation signal. Okay? And if there's no other signal, this activation signal is going to cause swelling of Morula cells into the tips of the ampullae. If there's no further signal, the epithelium of these ampullae become leaky, these cells pour out, and you get a rejection response. However, if there is a missing self-recognition response, that'll initiate vascular remodeling and form a parabiotic pair. Okay? So, but one of the most confusing things to me is I tell you about the secreted form, but I don't know how a secreted form could be a ligand. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We don't have we kind of have evidence that it's actually secreted. It looks like it's secreted. But how you could release a secreted molecule and then know its source is not really known. Okay, so let me finish up here. So I started out by telling you that L recognition is pretty much seen in all metazoan phyla. Okay. But we know there's no conservation of the MHC, which is responsible in us, in the basal vertebrates like the lampreys and the hagfish. there's no conservation of the lamprey proteins that are being, and there's a whole nother response in lampreys I didn't tell you about, done by mostly by Max Cooper. There's other proteins involved in that, but they're not found in any other organisms either. They seem to be unique. There's no conservation of the FUG or the other proteins, even in other species of ascidians where the genome's been sequenced. And cnidarian allorecognition molecules, I showed you the coral and the hydractinia, they're not related to what we study. And none of these are in the sponge genome. I also showed you the sponge response. So what's going on? Okay. There are two familiar characteristics of Petrolis allorecognition. One is genetic. There's linked receptor families which are both polymorphic and polygenic. Okay, so fester is polygenic. We have these linked receptor systems. This is something that we see in the vertebrate genomes. And there's functional, and that's the outcomes are determined by an integration of signals from these linked genes. And they seem to be, and maybe I'm stretching a little, but we'll call it activating and inhibitory. So there's two hypotheses we're coming to now. Either highly polymorphic allorecognition systems are due to convergent evolution throughout the metazoa, or we've been looking at the wrong place for conservation, and that's what I think is going on. So when the genomes are searching again and I looked around, I found that the immune signaling pathways are conserved. Sponges have ZAP70, AFIN, SHIP1, SHIP. Cnidarians have this beautiful CD45 homolog in them, as well as all the signaling molecules that are involved in most innate and adaptive immune responses. And to conclude, what I think we're seeing is functional conservation, okay? And I think the conservation might be at the intracellular level. And I've just shown this way. This was by Gary Lippmann, where we see, this is with some proteins he had discovered in the fish genome, and this is the same for NK cells, and that is there's a kinase pathway that activates, there's a phosphatase pathway that can block that, and this pathway is eventually going to give rise to some sort of response. Okay? Now, almost all immune function in the vertebrates is due to integration of multiple pathways. Okay? And often, these pathways are linked to a diverse set of non-orthologous receptors. And this is, I think, exactly what we see in natural killer cell evolution. You have LIF49s, which are C-type lectins. You have KIRs. They're both hooked up to the same intracellular wiring. Okay? So what our hypothesis is that what is conserved and what's been around forever is the intracellular wiring. Because no matter what goes on, you have to have some sort of education process. In order to achieve specificity, cells have to figure out what is the response, what is the level where they're going to respond of activation. And I think that's what's been conserved through evolution. So I think Petrolis is a great model to look at this, because we know instead of having the multiple pathways, I mean, we started off this talk about the 3,000 to 16,000 different NK cell subsets, right? As a system, how NK achieves allorecognition is much different than here. We have a very much simplified version of that. We have two inputs now, one through fester and one through uncle fester. Those are integrated. Somehow the cell is deciding how to respond. There must be, what we think is conserved are mechanisms of tolerance and mechanisms of education. And that's the conclusion right here. So just to reiterate, we think conservation and polymorphic allorecognition is not in the ligands and receptors, but how the cells respond to events at the cell surface during both development, which we call education, and over time, tolerance. And this can explain what we see in NK cells, the rapid evolution of things on the cell surface. There's a war going on the cell surface, but it's all linked down to a common mechanism that allows the cells to integrate those signals. So it doesn't matter what's going on the cell surface. What matters is how the cell's educated and how the cell responds to the stimulations that are going on. So it's this integration that's conserved. And Petrolis is a highly simplified model to look at that, because we seem to have only two inputs. So we have not linked fester or uncle fester signaling to those pathways yet, but that's what we're doing right now. So I'm going to finish there. Thank you.